Hello, everyone, and welcome to Autism and Neurodiversity in the Workplace. I'm your host, Matt Nelson, and joining me are a panel of guests who have some connection to either autism or neurodiversity within their place of work. Today's topic is working with autism or neurodiversity in collegiate athletics. Before we begin with questions, we're going to go around the room so that everyone can introduce themselves. I'm going to go last. So we'll go in, I guess, counterclockwise based on how everyone is pictured on my screen. So with that being said, AJ, we will start with you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. My name is AJ O'Hagan, and I'm on the autism spectrum. I have a younger brother, Nikki, who's also on the autism spectrum, as well as my goddaughter, Natalie, who's also my niece. She's on the autism spectrum, and she is 8 years old, and she has a lot of energy, and my brother is awesome, and he's sort of like my best friend. He is my best friend, practically, and we have so much in common. Plus, it's been a great experience. I have another best friend, Allison Hogue, on the autism spectrum, so autism has had a big impact on me, not just for myself, but for my family members and friends. And I'm the sports information director at Monroe College Bronx. I've been involved in college athletics since my freshman year of college in 2007. And I've been full-time in college athletics for over 8 years now. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been a great experience. And looking forward to talking with you guys tonight. And it should be a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks, AJ. And real quick, before we get to our next member of the panelists, when were you diagnosed as autistic?
I was diagnosed when I was 2 years old. I wasn't speaking at all, and my family was concerned, so they took me to get evaluated, and that's when I got diagnosed with autism.
All right, very good. Next person on the panel is Mike Puglisi. Mike, the floor is yours.
Right. Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Puglisi. I have a very different kind of experience. I am on the autism spectrum. It's just kind of a different experience for me because I was diagnosed very late. I wasn't diagnosed until I was 18 years old after I graduated high school, because I was more towards the higher functioning end. So I guess as younger, you're going through, you know, childhood, teenage years, all that. It's not something that I guess was picked up on, or at least I didn't pick up on it. I had to, you know, go for some tests because of some stuff for college. And I met with a psychiatrist, and he was like, "Hey, by the way, you're on the autism spectrum." And I said, "Come again?" I was just, kind of out of nowhere. So there wasn't any way that sent me to get a test for it, or it was something that was even thought of. I just happened to, go into a psychiatrist because I had to get a test one day, and that bombshell got dropped on me. And naturally I kind of panicked and started doing research, and oh my God, am I going to be able to have a normal job and live a normal life and all the rest of it. And, kind of thankfully I have. And as far as my connection to the sports information world, I was, full-time in sports information for 5+ years. I made the decision last summer to get out. But again, I don't, to my knowledge, I don't have any relatives that have, actually, no, my cousin's son just recently got diagnosed, actually, in the last few months or so. I also have, a few friends of mine are on the autism spectrum as well. So I do have some connection to it outside of myself, but just really looking forward to getting the chance to talk with all of you about it. And looking forward to having a lot of fun with what we discussed tonight.
Now, Mike, one thing I just noticed when you were introducing yourself, used the term higher functioning, which for a number of folks who may not be familiar, the terms high or low functioning may come off as problematic or offensive to some who are on the spectrum. So when it comes to your support needs, how would you classify those? Would you say you have high support needs? Are they low, or could they be medium?
I mean, for myself, I don't see any, as far as like the support I need, not a whole lot. That obviously, varies from person to person. There are obviously some people on the autism spectrum that are nonverbal and, need almost 24/7 support. None of us are, at that level. As far as support for me, the most I've had to deal with is just kind of occasionally needing to, talk to someone, because one of the things with autism, people are a lot more susceptible to, having anxiety, stress, depression, things of that nature, which, I have all of the above. So sometimes it's just a matter of, I wouldn't say, yeah, that's about as far as the support goes, just like needing to, you know, kind of vent a little bit, or just, you know, having someone to talk to, or, you know, things along those lines.
But what's most important, based on your setting or background, at least, you are able to live under your own roof, pay bills, make ends meet financially. So more towards the line of maybe low support needs. Am I saying that right? Would you think?
Yeah. Okay. You know, like I said, there are some people that, you know, need almost, you know, kind of 24/7 support. I, you know, as far as, you know, needing, you know, assistance, I don't really need any assistance. It's just more of like a, or like I said, kind of occasionally needing to talk to someone is about as far as I would go with that.
Exactly. The last person on the panel before we go to yours truly is Alan. Correct me if I'm saying your last name wrong. Is it Weiderholdson? Weiderholdson? Which one is it?
Alan Weiderholdson. I'm the sports information director at Houston Tillotson University in Austin, Texas. We are a NAIA and an HBCU and an NAIA member institution. When AJ brought this up, the idea for this panel and these talks up for in our social media groups, it was the neurodivergency was the key word that caught my attention. I was more or less diagnosed, or at least given the possibility that I had a attention deficit disorder or ADHD when I was 25 and in my first year of graduate or third semester of graduate school. And that was in 2005. At the same time, I was diagnosed with depression too. So for me, I haven't had a lot of experience in terms of dealing with whether I've had interest in knowing whether I fall somewhere on the autism spectrum, but in the meantime, I've just, since that time, about 20 years ago, I've been trying to manage what it's like just to have a neurodivergent brain and interests that don't necessarily align with my peers and family members. So, but that's why I was glad to be part of this this panel discussion.
Yeah, I think special interest is definitely something that a lot of people who are not autistic and or neurodivergent have, to an extent, a difficult time understanding. For example, one of my special interests is NASCAR. And when in the past I've brought it up to extended relatives, it's like the last thing they want to hear out of my mouth. There are other reasons why my relationship with them went sour, but we'll get to that at a later time. For people who don't know exactly where your line of work is located within Houston, can you give us a little sense of where the school is located? Because this is the first time I'm actually hearing of this school. Granted, I've never worked with any NAIA programs as a freelancer.
Well, actually, it's kind of a misnomer. It's the Houston in Houston Tillotson University is not spelled with an O. There's no O in it. It's just six letters, Houston, and it's in Austin, Texas. We are just east of I-35 in the traditionally black part of Austin, although that's getting heavily gentrified as the cost of living and the cost of property is going through the roof here in Austin. But we are an HBCU, and this is where I got my start in sports information. As my first non-student job was here about in 2007. And so this is my I'm completing my first year as a full-time SID here, after being around multiple Division Ones and Division Threes and NAIAs.
Mm. Well, back to where you started from, right? All right.
It was always my dream to be back here. So.
Well, with that being said, let me introduce myself. So my name is Matt Nelson. Unlike the rest of the panel, I am not in sports information at the present moment. I was in sports information several years ago as an assistant at Muhlenberg College in the Lehigh Valley area of Pennsylvania. That was a 6-month job that ultimately was not meant for me in the long haul. So what do I do nowadays? Well, I am the owner of Nelson Voices LLC. I am a voice actor and live event sports announcer, which is another way of saying public address announcer. I've been in the announcing industry for the past 8 years or so. My current clients nowadays include FDU, also known as the team that upset Purdue in the first round of March Madness a year ago, along with St. Thomas Aquinas College. I do select sports for the Spartans up in Rockland County, New York, as well as Real Central NJ Soccer in the USL2 and WPSL. So I am not in collegiate athletics on a full-time basis, but I have worked hand-in-hand with AJ and Mike on a number of events in the past, Alan obviously being in a completely different part of the country. This is our first go-around meeting each other. So nice to meet you all again. And why don't we get started? Once again, folks, the topic is working with autistic and neurodivergent individuals within collegiate athletics. So the first question is a bit of a generalized way of getting things started. And the question is, what does being a neurodivergent individual mean to you when working or in, if you were to put yourself in someone else's shoes, say a collegiate athlete, when it comes to playing in collegiate athletics? Whoever would like to go, please raise your hand. All right, AJ, since you can't find the raise hand button on Zoom, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you. So pretty much, like I know, like athletes, for example, I mean, individuals on the autism spectrum, they get stereotyped for not being good athletes or anything, or not playing sports at all. Like when I was in college, I did play sports, not for an NCAA level team, but I played a lot of intramurals, and I always had great experiences. I think the key was like knowing what my limits were as a player. Like, for example, in basketball, I wasn't good at dribbling, but I was good at shooting and playing defense. So it was like that. So that's how, like, I got practice. With practice, I became a lot better at being an athlete and everything, not just basketball, but other sports. But I know that there's plenty of individuals on the autism spectrum that have competed in sports, such as cross country and basketball. And I think the main thing what we all want is to be treated like everyone else. Like, we don't want any special treatment. It's okay to criticize us. It's okay to have constructive criticism, as long as it's obviously legit and as long as you do the same thing for everybody else. On the opposite end, if you're the only one that's getting criticized just because you feel like the boss feels like it's much easier to criticize someone with a disability or on the spectrum because of the negative stereotypes we face, and that's an issue as well. The main thing is we just want to be treated equally, pretty much, and I feel like that's where leadership is, like whether it's positive or negative. Like, we just want to be treated the same way you would treat a neurotypical, for example, which means a person that doesn't have a disability. And I think that's the main thing right there. Now, when it comes to going back to the athletes, even if a person on the spectrum or any other disability is not good enough to make a college team, I feel like there are plenty of roles that they could still be on the team. Like, for example, when I was in college, I was the video coordinator for our men's ice hockey team. I got to travel with the team, do in-game video breakdown of all their home and road games. I felt like I was a part of the team, and hockey is one of those sports where I was not good at all. I couldn't play hockey at all. I feel like all my weaknesses would be exploited if I played sports such as hockey, like hand-eye coordination and stuff like that. But the players and the coaches, they treated me like I was a member of the team, even though I didn't play at all. And I still got the experience of being part of a team and working with the student athletes. And it was a great experience. So maybe for the athletic administrators, for coaches, you could still put someone that has a disability, such as autism or any other type of disability, you could still have them on or her on the team, and still being a part of and being a key member of the team, and doing a job behind the scenes. And I think that's worth just as much as you are playing or coaching. So I think there's plenty of spots for a person with a neurological disability to be an effective member on a team?
Yeah, I could never get myself into hockey, at least growing up. That was until the pandemic started and I tried my hand at announcing NAHL and NA3HL hockey with the New Jersey Titans. I felt like the experience definitely helped because it parlayed into becoming the voice of the Metropolitan Riveters until the league that they were a part of, their assets were purchased by Billie Jean King and Mark Walters, which eventually became the PWHL. We're going to turn it over now over to Mike Gleese. Mike, take it away.
Thanks, Matt. So I just wanted to follow up, or I guess kind of touch on a few things that AJ said. When he says, or I don't want to speak for him, but I think what he's kind of getting at is when he says, you know, there are roles that you can carve out for people on the autism spectrum in athletics. And they, like, nobody's looking for, hey, this person has autism, so let's just give them something to do. We want to, or I think everybody should feel like we are giving this person this position or this role because they can succeed in it and they can grow in it and they can learn from it. And quite frankly, they're probably the best person for the job at it, because people on the autism spectrum have just have things like little niches that they're very good at, and they're able to kind of take that and run with it. And, you know, once they get going and get comfortable in whatever it is they're doing, routine is obviously a big thing for people on the autism spectrum. So once you get going, it's almost like, I don't know that there are many people better for the job. That's just, you know, kind of my take on that. Another thing he was talking about earlier was, you know, just kind of, you know, about criticism, about things like that. Communication is so key in with any person on autism, because, you know, there are times where, you know, people say something to me and, like, at least for me, I need things explained, like you're talking almost to a toddler. Like, it's just one of those things, like, unless you are very specifically, I'm looking for XYZ, I'm not going to know that you're looking for XYZ. I'm just going to, I take things at face value. That's just how it is. You know, for me, I don't want to speak for anybody else. That's just kind of my experience. So just making sure to communicate as well as possible and keeping people up to date and, you know, kind of explain things, even if as an administrator, you need to take an extra minute or two to fully explain, this is what I'm looking for, this is what I need you to do. That's just something that I think should be done. I think it's very important as well.
Absolutely. I think communication is extremely key when it comes to working within this industry, because there are so many moving parts and pieces, so many logistics that go into all these things that administrators are looking for, especially when it comes to you fellas who work in sports info and have one of the most unique job titles out of just about anyone, because you guys are working nonstop. You're making sure the stats are correct. You're making sure that other things are as accurate and as good as they possibly can be. And there are times when people simply just don't give us clear-cut instructions. The one thing I've learned since I opened up about being autistic a couple of years ago, and for the record, I was diagnosed at the age of 2, is that people need to be direct with us, okay? Don't sugarcoat things to make it sound like, oh, you need to do this, but then there's, you know, a whole other thing that goes on top of it. So that's a great point by you, Mike. Alan.
I wanted to follow up on something that Mike said about neurodivergent individuals having their niche that they are very good at. And growing up, I mean, it makes sense now, but I mean, well before I was diagnosed with anything neurodivergent, I'm not even sure, like, we knew what the term, if that term even existed when I was in high school in the previous century. But, you know, I was the type of person who could name, like, all, you know, World Series champions way back to almost the beginning. I still think I could do it for about 95% of the ones that have been played. So when I found out that there's a sports information as a job, like on the collegiate setting, I was already in college, and but it was in my first semester. So I knew pretty early on that this is kind of the thing I wanted to do, where it would, you know, something would, my interests and my hyper-focus on this would come in handy. And so that's something that's kind of been continuous since I was in college, and I graduated in 2003. And then, you know, I've been doing this more or less full-time since 2007. And so that was just real eye-opening that, you know, there are places where my talents and my interests can be used. And that includes being a small college athletics too. I know a lot more about Subdivision I colleges than I did going out, leaving high school.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, thinking about all the different types of clients I've worked with over the years, if you were tell me that, you know, I would know certain fun facts about like St. Thomas Aquinas sprint football and who like some of the top players are and how long they've been around. And the fact that this past year was their first winning season in program history, or at least I think it was, I would have thought you were crazy. But here we are, you know, like 5 years after I started working for Stack, and it really amazes me not only to know who the top players are, but also to see them understand the value of what I bring to the table. And now I'm doing more sports for them as of this past fall. We're going to move on to our next question. And this has to do with the ADA, and we'll touch base on this as well. So the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits workplace harassment and employment discrimination based on an individual's neurodivergent condition, as well as employer retaliation against employees who report or complain about discrimination against those who are neurodivergent. So how does your employer or employers prevent discrimination against them in the hiring process?
So AJ, go ahead. I think like it's important like during the interview sessions, because I know it's like when they interview people, like I always hear like criticisms, like when they interview someone, oh, this person, I try to like go like this to them, you know, just see like how they would react and everything. And they seem startled. I don't know if they would be a good fit or something like that. And I go, and I'm just thinking like that's not good, because like I know like a lot of people on the autism spectrum, I don't want to say like they're antisocial, but they're not really, they're more prone to being shy and a little uncomfortable speaking. And I'm just not a fan when people like nitpick against like someone that doesn't have the right posture or doesn't make contact. I think a true essence of the interview should be getting to know somebody, like getting to know their personality and like just getting to know them, and just to verify what they say on the resume is true. Not so much what they, not so much what they're wearing or what their position is or how long it takes to answer a question. Cause I think it's more about like getting to know each other. Like for me personally, like it takes me a little while, but then when I get to know someone, I become more comfortable, become more outgoing, but you won't realize that in an interview. Like don't like deny someone that's clearly good for the job just because of some minor signs based pretty much. So I feel like there'll be more like autistics and neurodivergent people on the job if like they would just explain, like if the person doing the hiring process would just understand that people are pretty much, they know the answers, they know how to do the job, they have a lot of great experience. Just take it at face value and just use the interview to get to know the person pretty much.
Thanks, AJ. Mike, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so for me, I'm just speaking from my personal experience. You know, I fill out an application and like everybody sees, you know, those like voluntary self-ID things. Are you military? Do you have a disability, et cetera? You know, always check yes. Weirdly enough for me, it's something that's never been brought up by an employer in an interview. I've mentioned it in situations where I felt like it was relevant to what we were talking about or what I was being asked. As far as, you know, like certain things during interviews, like I've never personally had that experience of somebody like, you know, trying to like, quote unquote, feel me out based on, you know, the disability, because I don't even think people are allowed to ask what disability you have if you do check yes on that. I think that's part of the ADA thing as well, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know that for 100% fact, but I think that's the case. So I've never really had, you know, that kind of situation where I've had to deal with something like that. But, you know, regardless, it just, even if you do know, if you're aware of the situation, just pretty much like AJ said before, just act like it's any other person. Just like, just treat everybody the same. That's pretty much all anybody's looking for here, is just to be looked at and viewed the same as everyone else. And, you know, I think there are steps that have, you know, been taken in recent years where, you know, particularly for, you know, people like us who not only on the autism spectrum, but, you know, mental health is a big part of it as well, where, you know, particularly for men to talk about mental health is like, has been stigmatized a lot, you know, particularly in recent years. And, you know, there's been more of a conversation about it. So again, really all anybody's just looking for is just view me like you would view any other candidate, ask me the same questions, you know, act the same way. That's pretty much all, again, all anybody's looking for.
I love what you said about, you know, how we all need to be treated as human, just like everyone else on this planet. And there have been a select number of occasions, not anything recently in my time in working in sports, but every once in a while, someone will notice the neurodiversity lanyard that I wear with me wherever I go. And it does make them curious. Or if I'm wearing my Loop Experience earplugs in a loud or noisy environment, they'll ask about those if they're like hearing aids or like, hey, well, why are you wearing these? And for me, the simple answer is I have sensory needs. Now, if they want to know more about that, well, then it's up to me to decide, do I want to go into further detail and tell them I'm autistic or I'm neurodivergent or, you know, tell them I have ADHD? Or is it information that I feel like this person could use to say something that may not come out necessarily appropriate for me? So it really is up to you when it comes to, you know, being dealt these questions, maybe not by an administrator, but maybe just by any ordinary colleague that crosses your plate. So AJ and Mike have already gone. Alan, that means you're the last person who needs to respond.
Well, this is one of those areas where I don't have as much experience because I've only recently, within the last 3 or 4 years, even started, answering yes to do I have anything that falls under the disabilities criteria when applying for jobs, which sadly I have too much experience applying for jobs over the last few years. That I do have kind of a reputation in amongst my SID community here for jumping around places, but yeah, it was within the last 3 years that I even started listening, like, you know, answering yes to that question, then probably not even going into it very much. And that's just for depression, not even so much my neurodivergent tendencies, because that's the only one I really have documentation for. And I also feel that, you know, this college athletics is my happy place. So I'm not sure if, you know, that really becomes a factor in, you know, do I need accommodations for my job? So what Mike and AJ have talked about are very enlightening to me. And that's, you know, so I feel like as I'm giving information in this podcast, I'm also receiving a lot of great information in this podcast that could help my career in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing I just realized to touch on Mike's statement, when it comes to filling out job applications where you get down to the section where it talks about, you know, have you served in the military or do you have a disability? I had no idea I was autistic until I was in my first year at a four-year college. One of my roommates was autistic. My family came down for a visit and they met him and clearly realized from the moment they laid eyes on him that there was something a little unusual about him. And my sister blurted out, well, Matt, you know you're autistic too, right? And I was like, I was shocked. Because I didn't think there was anything different or wrong or strange about me, which I later realized at the end of that conversation was the reason why I have very few friends nowadays. And what I've also decided to do, by choice for the record, is if I'm filling out a job application and I see that question come up about, are you disabled or do you have a disability? I put down yes. I think when it comes to that, they have every right to know. And if they want to follow up with more information, if they want to know more, I can straight up tell them I'm ADHD and, you know, I'm neurodivergent. And they want to look at it at a great way, perfect. If not, well, chances are it's probably someone I don't want to work for. With that being said, let's move on to our third question of the evening. And this question is something I think will definitely help with neurotypicals who are listening to this. And the question is, what are some ways to work with neurodivergent individuals who are struggling to get through their day at work? Mike, you're up first.
So I would say this is something that I kind of touched on a little bit before. First of all, just I would say obviously communicate almost to the point where you're like over communicating, and just, you know, speaking from my personal experience, make sure the person understands what it is you're looking for, what it is you want, what you're expecting of them. Because if you don't do that, you know, somebody, you know, a neurodivergent person may not fully grasp exactly what it is you're expecting. As far as, you know, in the workplace, you know, kind of on a day-to-day, not that it's something you have to ask on a day-to-day basis, but just check in with the person every now and again. How are you feeling? Are you doing okay? Do you need to talk to somebody? Like, just, you know, kind of extending that hand every now and then, so that if somebody is in a position where, you know, they're down or they're feeling something's off or whatever the case might be, just know that we have whatever resources available that we have available, and we're happy to let you know about them, and you can go, you know, get whatever assistance you might need. And I think it's stuff that really, it requires really minimal effort on the part of a lot of people to just, you know, just extend that extra hand, or, you know, ask that one question here or there. But, you know, and that's kind of part of the problem, is a lot of people don't, most people don't, I would say. So just kind of, you know, if you're in that position as an administrator, just, you know, check in with the person every now and again. Again, it doesn't have to be every day. Be once a month for all. I mean, that's a good first step. You know, do it once a month. Just check how are you doing? Do you need any help? You know, not that you're going to assume anything is wrong with somebody, but it's just kind of a courtesy thing for me. And that's just, I think that would be just a good place to start for anybody in that kind of administrative role.
Yeah, I agree. I think the other point of it too, Mike, is that as long as that person isn't hounding us, making sure we're okay, like, if they were to ask that question every day, I would get a little annoyed and frustrated. But that's just me personally, especially because I know, like, at my day job at the time of this recording, you know, if someone's looking at me when I'm just clearly not doing well, I think they've learned to realize, okay, Matt's not doing well right now. Let's give him some space, leave him alone, and see if he can get his thoughts together before becoming a little bit more sane. Alan, go right ahead.
Yes, I wanted to follow up on what Mike said too, especially about communication to the point of over-communication, especially when it comes to like meeting expectations and goals. I mean, what I've also told family members, and when I was married, told my wife that it was, you know, sometimes I need to be told things two or three times for me to truly understand what's going on. And I guess looking back, that should have been a sign of neurodivergency too. But for me, it's just clearly stating goals and expectations would be what I would think would help. And for me, and maybe anyone else who might, you know, be classified as neurodivergent too, one area I struggle in is that is when I'm not given regular feedback, is that I kind of worry, am I doing enough to, am I doing my job right? And fortunately, I get enough affirmation about my job too, but, and that not just here, but at other places I've been at previously too, but it's, you know, that the affirmation's good, but having clear goals helps me kind of stay on task.
I also think it's good to make the initial effort if you have the kind of administrator that doesn't necessarily do, for example, like you said, Alan, monthly, I guess, reports to like see how you're doing and if there are ways you can improve what it is that, you know, you're doing within your job, is take the initiative, walk up to them or send them an email and say, hey, I was wondering if you could, you know, maybe give me like a monthly report on how I'm doing and if there are, you know, ways I can do better, or if there are ways maybe I can tone it down a little bit, that'd be great. So I think that's really a smart thing that I think more people need to start doing, is taking initiative and realizing that, again, if they have the type of boss or administrator that doesn't check in, be proactive and let them know, hey, I want to know how I'm doing. I want to make sure that I'm living up to your expectations. I'm putting in the time, the work, and the effort into my job. AJ, you have yet to go yet. Would you like to respond to this question?
Oh, sure. And I feel like I think this one's a little more specific related, but I know it's typical for an autistic person to love their routines, and I'm strongly impacted by routines on the job. Like, for example, Monday's the day I usually do like student athlete of the week, email rosters out to the opposing SITs, setting up the live stats links and the video for the week and stuff like that, and weekly nominations, of course. So I always try to establish that on Monday. Like, what I'm having a hard time during the spring season is because, like, baseball and softball, our softball and baseball teams often play games on Monday as opposed to our fall and winter sports. And I, like, and just focus so much on preparing, like, for those games for that Monday. It completely throws your routine off out of whack. And, like, for example, I forgot to nominate our players this week, and I forgot to do this until the next day. So it throws everything off. And the main thing, so going back to the question, the main thing I would hope is that like administrators and coaches would be understanding of why I didn't do it today, or why I didn't do it, why is it taking so long and stuff like that. And I've never had an issue with coaches or administrators taking issues if something's off. But at the same time, if someone's like struggling, something seems out of whack, I think like the administrators and the coaches could talk to the SID, give them a heads up, not so much to criticize, but just say, hey, how come this wasn't done yet? And I could explain the situation. And in the end, of course, it's something I do have to adjust. Like I have to prepare for that possibility to happen. Like next week, I need to come up with a better game plan so I could still be able to do everything in a timely fashion while preparing for that Monday game. So, of course, it's something I need to turn around and improve upon. But at the same time, at least in the short term, especially like this is my first or second week with this happening. Just everyone, like if they could like be patient, and I'll be able to get it all done. But it's probably just going to be a little different. I have to change my routine a little bit. And if it's still an issue the fourth or the fifth week, then I got to like seriously assess something, because it still needs to get done. It still needs to get done. I can't make any excuses. But at the same time, if they can understand that it's a little bit of a learning curve, and by the third or the fourth week, if we have those Monday games, I'll be able to set a new schedule, prepare like for my other usual Monday routines.
And this kind of touches based on my next question. And the question is, what are some strategies you or your employer have worked with when it comes to figuring out the strengths and weaknesses of an autistic and or neurodivergent employee, or an autistic and or neurodivergent independent contractor? I know some of the people in this room are both. So, Mike, go ahead.
There we go. All right. So I would say, you know, for me, there was never really a specific strategy where there was like, I sat down with somebody and we came up with a game plan of this is how we're going to address X, Y, Z. Maybe that's something that should be done. For me, like, on the most part, things were just kind of done on the fly. If there was ever like a situation that kind of arose, we would, you know, just kind of sit there, you know, figure it out as we went along. That's just, again, just kind of, you know, how, you know, I've had, you know, going through my career, you know, in college athletics, where, you know, it's not like I ever hid the information from anybody. I didn't just bring it up for the sake of bringing it up. It was, you know, it was relevant to, you know, the job or whatever it was. I would, you know, kind of tell people, hey, you know, I'm on the autism spectrum XYZ, blah, blah, blah. I'm not asking for anything special. I just, you know, need you to be as clear as you can with me. And that was pretty much the end of that. As far as, you know, plans to address situations. It was just, you know, if something ever came up on my end that I needed, or if there was something that was kind of lacking on my end that, you know, a manager or whoever needed to bring to me, they could bring it to me. And that was, you know, we were just kind of taking on a case by case basis. But I don't know, maybe, you know, it's different for other people who worked in other places, but I never actually had a situation where we came up with like a formal plan. And that's something now that you bring up, it makes a lot of sense, because you can kind of, when you do it that way, you can kind of prevent any issue before it comes up in some situations. Some things you can't, but that's a situation where you potentially can. So having that kind of planning going ahead of time, I think is something that actually is a very good idea and something that a lot of places should be kind of thinking about getting into.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like going in with some sort of plan can definitely help make things better, not just in the short term, but also in the long term. And if you need to be, you know, upfront with a disability or something that's maybe a little bit different about you than the rest of the gang, it is okay to bring up, but you do it at your leisure. You don't have to do it right then in the moment. You could also do it at a certain time of day. Heck, it doesn't even have to be in person. You can simply send them an email. That way you can clear things up with them and there's no harm and no foul going forward. There's a better understanding between both sides. Alan.
Well, and as a follow-up too, you know, Mike mentioned a lot of great things there. And for me, it's making to-do lists. I feel like I'm at my most organized on my day-to-day routines, or maybe if it's an unusual day in terms of assignments or pressing issues that need to be addressed, it's making to-do lists. I mean, and that probably would help anybody, not just neurodivergent individuals, but for me, it helps me to stay on task and keep my eyes on the end goal for that day.
AJ.
And I feel like the year-end evaluations, which I know pretty much all jobs offer, I think that's a good time to sit with your boss and to go over some things, like obviously what he or she wants you to do better. And then you explain, like obviously you got to take accountability. And also, but use this as an opportunity to explain to your boss, the reason why this situation happened, and then they could... You both could work together to figure out a resolution that could help both parties pretty much and understand it takes good human skills to reach an agreement about we'll do it this way you just gotta make sure you get this done at this point because I've always for my previous bosses and my current bosses, they do a great job of teaching me what to prioritize, to make sure that they're very clear in their communication, and that goes a long way. But I think the year-end evaluations, when you have that meeting, you go over stuff from each of your ends. I think that's been a big help for me in the past, and it's helped me be where I am today and to limit my weaknesses and to work on things to try to make me get better at the job.
Now, for those who may not be familiar when it comes to working in collegiate athletics, the collegiate academic season typically starts on July 1st. That is the quote-unquote new year of the college athletics season. Obviously, fall sports don't start until August, but then the athletic calendar wraps up on the last day of June. I've got there's 30 or 31 days. So AJ, when you talk about those year-end evaluations, are you specifically speaking about evaluations that happen at the end of the academic year / athletic year, or at the end of the calendar year?
I would say usually in the past, at my previous jobs, they would always happen at the end of May, early June. So it's more of a reflection of the athletic season, not so much the academic or fiscal year, but more of the athletic season pretty much. And then we review it at the end of May, early June to prepare to get better for July onwards.
Gotcha. Now, since some of you guys are employers, I don't know if any of you have worked with anyone who is autistic and or neurodivergent within your fields, but this question is for employers. And if you're not an employer or if you have never been an employer, put yourself into the shoes of one. What are some basic ways to accommodate autistic and or neurodivergent employees during both game days and non-game days? And this is regardless of the sport or sports that you have on your calendars. AJ.
I think the key is just to like I said, with the routines, just try to do best you can. Like, I would say maybe at the beginning of the year or the week, just say like, hey, what do you usually like to do during game days? What's your routine? Do you like to have meetings or to prepare for this upcoming game night or game day? Or do you need to work by yourself and just be the expression says, let yourself cook, you know, just get all your responsibilities done on game day and get everything done. And then the game day happens and then you execute the game. But I also think a big part is, and this is not so much on the autism spectrum or any disabilities, but I would feel if somebody wants to come in at 12 o'clock at noon for a 7 o'clock game, but not be in the office till 12 o'clock, I think that should be fine. Cause I know it's not so much a disability issue, but you don't want to have burnout. You don't want to burn out your employees. So I think maybe letting them come into the office at 12 o'clock, get a good night's sleep the night before, just since it's going to be a long night of writing recaps, working the game earlier, and then preparing the game leading up to it. So I think it's just letting them do their routines. And but I think it's important for us to communicate with our bosses as well. Say if we were the bosses, we make sure you say hey, anything you need, your schedules or anything, just let us know. And that's what we got to do ourselves. Like me as an employee, I got to let my boss know, at least request, hey, can I come in late this day, or can I can I just spend a couple of, is it possible we can reschedule our meeting until the next day? Cause today's game day, and I just want to prepare and everything. Obviously communication is a two-way street, but usually if everything's stored up well in advance and we communicate with each other, things will be a lot better. Things end up being a lot better.
Mike, go ahead.
Yes. So first of all, to bounce off what AJ said, I'm a very big proponent of the 12-hour rule. Meaning if you don't leave until 11, you don't come in till 11 the next day. I think that's always a 12-hour rule has always been my kind of go-to, and I'm a very big fan of it. Sometimes obviously not possible, but try to use it when you can. If you're an employer, just to, again, like AJ said, kind of avoid burnout to some extent. I mean, this is just a profession where burnout's inevitably going to happen at some point or another during the year, particularly during this very time of year, or I guess a month ago from now, because crossover. But something, you know, to kind of go back to the question of what an employer can do, this is something that I never did while I was actually in the profession. But now that I look back, it's something that I think I probably should have done and would have been a very good idea, is to just, you know, write things down. You know, as far as game day operations, this is everything we need. If we're doing, you know, we have baseball today, what is everything we need to bring to the field? What do we need to do? What time do we need to be there to make sure that everything is up and ready to go in time? And, you know, troubleshooting stuff, you know, if something goes down, here's our checklist of here's what we do to get things back going up. So just having actually something written down on a piece of paper could go such a long way to helping somebody. Cause when things kind of go sideways, you're kind of in panic mode and you're trying to, you know, do the first thing that comes to your mind. But if you actually have something right there in front of you where you sit there and say, okay, here's what we do when this happens, it's just something, it's such a little thing, just kind of writing it on a piece of paper. But to me, I feel like it's something that could go such a long way in kind of helping make those stressful situations just a little bit less stressful. So that's something, you know, as an employer, I definitely would do. You know, I probably should have done that while I was working in the profession as is. It's just something I never thought to do, but it's just something that I think would be very helpful for even for people that aren't on the autism spectrum, you know, just having that whole checklist. Here's what we need. Here's what time we need to get there, X, Y, Z. And you just kind of go from there.
For anyone who is or is not in sports, the three key words I just took away from Mike's response, write it down. Otherwise, you're going to forget. Now, if you do have the kind of, you know, mental thinking where you can, you know, put things in your head, okay, that's different. But it is also never a bad thing to write things down. Alan?
Well, I've rarely been in a position where I was the supervisor, but as both a subordinate and as a supervisor, I would think, you know, that the things that both Mike and AJ said, you know, and would be key here, and that is write it down and communication. I think that applies whether it's game day or any other aspect of the job. I mean, you know, game day is where people will notice, are more likely to notice your mistakes. But I think that, you know, that same principle applies, you know, make sure you have well communicated ideas and responsibilities and everyone's on the same page. And also I do need to hold myself to that 12-hour rule a little bit better too, even though I'm getting better at it now, but should be, you know, still maintaining that for life work balance.
Gotta love that 12-hour rule. You leave at 11 or 12, you don't come in until 12 o'clock the next day. Love it. I now want you guys to put yourselves into the shoes of an employee, a student worker, or an intern for this next question. What are some accommodations you'd like to discuss with your employers if you are obviously autistic or neurodivergent? Or maybe something that you could have thought of years ago when you were in the position of being a student worker or intern, Alan.
Well, thank you. At least in my experience, I should say, it's really just comes down to written communication, you know, very clearly set expectations for the job. And then also whether I'm telling my situation to a supervisor or if someone comes to me and says that they are a neurodivergent individual, is let's have that discussion with how best do you respond? What are the best ways for you to get your work done? And what is it that you need from a support standpoint? And I think it starts with just, you know, being open and honest and being a welcoming environment to where someone can talk about that.
I'm sorry, I was just muted, and that is on me. Alan, thank you. Mike.
So, I mean, for me, the thing I would do is kind of go in, you know, talk to supervisor, administrator, whoever it is, and just kind of tell them, these are the ways I feel I'm most effective working, whether, you know, whatever that may be. I learn better by watching visually. I learn better by, you know, writing things down or just doing them on the fly, whatever it is, just kind of go in and explain to people, this is the way I work best. This is the way I'm able to pick things up easiest. And if you have a, you know, supervisor, administrator, be receptive to that and say, okay, how do we do that? What do you want to do? What are some kind of things that you want to get going with so that once, you know, we can get you moving as fast as possible. Like say, for example, this is a person starting in a brand new role. Just go in first few days. These are some things I feel good at. Here's where I need to improve. Here's the way I learn most effectively. Because people from, who are on, you know, kind of the autism spectrum, they, at least for me, like I process information, I guess, differently than anybody else. Than, you know, a neurotypical person. So me specifically, I learn better by kind of doing. Like I can sit there and I can visually like watch someone do it. Until I actually do it myself, I'm not going to pick up how to do it. Like somebody could write out perfectly clear instructions. Until I actually get in there and do whatever the job is, do it myself and make mistakes, I'm not going to know how to do it. Regardless of what is written down on a piece of paper, or I could watch, I have literally had this happen where I've had supervisors do something, explain it to me. And they did it themselves. And I was standing right next to them watching. And then they said, okay, now you do this. And I was like, you know, it's just one of those things. Like for me, I learned better by, you know, doing it, making mistakes, doing it again. Eventually I'll get it right. And once I get it right, I will never forget it. But it's just, that's just me, how I work most effectively. So that's just something I would do, just kind of go in and, you know, explain to a supervisor, administrator, here's the way I learned best. Here's the way, you know, I think we should do things so that I can be the best employee I can be.
Yeah, agreed. And then it's up to them to decipher how to use that information to not only benefit themselves, but to benefit you, since you're the one working under them. Over to AJ.
And I think what we should all normalize, regardless of somebody's disability is being neurotypical, it's just basically having meetings right away with somebody, like before they start the job, saying like maybe the employer has any accommodations you need, and this is regardless if somebody has a disability or a neurotypical, and just because I know sometimes like people on the autism spectrum, they might not want to reveal they have a disability at least right away, and so maybe the employer could say to all new employees, any routines you want in this particular situation, any accommodations do you need? Like, for example, I know a student worker who's on the spectrum that might prefer to work, do office work, like on the laptop, like in an isolated area, like on his or her own, like just so they could feel more comfortable. Like, I'll give you an example. When I was in college, I had some accommodations. Like, I would take a test in like a private area in that classroom, because I always get like nervous when like people are like right next to me. Like, I always got nervous, like if I tilted my head, people would think like, oh, you're cheating, you're looking at the other person's paper, or you're looking at the other person. So I got always got like nervous with that. And so it caused me to be really stiff and just look down my own paper. So I wanted like more breathing room. So they gave me like, they let me take my test in like a private area, like a private, like closed off area. And so basically that same thing could happen to that student worker. Like, so maybe the student worker could bring up, you know, when I do my office work on the laptop, I prefer to like, do it in an area like away from people and stuff like that. So I think we should normalize like for all new employees, like I'm asking any special accommodations or something like that.
Excellent, excellent. Now I want each of you guys to put yourselves into the position of being an autistic/neurodivergent athlete. I know some of you guys have played sports when you were younger, whether it was in elementary, middle school, high school, even college. The question is, what are some accommodations you've discussed or would like to discuss with coaches and administrators? Again, put yourselves in the shoes of an autistic or neurodivergent athlete, not worker, but as a collegiate athlete. Alan.
Thank you. I was a kinesiology major myself, so I went through some of the coaching classes, and some of the best advices I got for coaches that were given to me by my professors who were coaches at my university is that knowing that not every player is going to be the same, and that's not necessarily just advice for dealing with a neurodivergent athlete. I mean, that's just knowing that every athlete is different. You're not going to be able to, I think the best coaches are the ones who realize that you can't, some of them you can yell at them and work them like a dog and they respond, and others that aren't, you know, it's just really knowing the strengths and weaknesses and the personalities of your athlete. So I think that is, I think that's just part of the coaches. What makes a successful coach is knowing how to push the right buttons for your athletes. And I think knowing who is neurodivergent or maybe even autistic is part of that.
You brought up a great point, because one thing that I've started to notice over the past few years is that regardless of what level of collegiate athletics I'm working in as a freelancer, I don't always see the same athletes who haven't graduated continue on with that specific sport from year to year. And a lot of it has to do with how their coach is when they're around them. You know, they're not a fan of how they are speaking with that individual. And so they think the best thing to do is either drop out, or if they want to continue their collegiate athletic career, they go transfer someone else or somewhere else and hope that their experience at said school is a much better experience than at their initial school. Mike?
So I think one thing, like every kind of coach in that situation should understand, if you're a student athlete in that position, by and large, obviously this isn't the case for everybody, by and large, people on the autism spectrum do not respond well to somebody screaming in their face. Not that many people do, but, you know, particularly people at me, if that happens, I shut down, I give a blank stare, and I don't say a word. I'm just, okay, just get out what you got to get out. Obviously, I know we're running out of time, so I'll try to make it quick. But I would just try to communicate to that coach as much as you can. I can take it chewing out. Like if I did something wrong, I messed up, I can take it. Just do it in a normal way. Don't get, 2 inches away from my face and scream at the top of your lungs, because I am not going to respond to that. I don't know many people, obviously, regardless of neurodivergent or neurotypical, that will. But just particularly people on the autism spectrum, a lot more delicate to a situation like that. So if you need to rip me for messing up, rip me for messing up, but do it in a reasonable way.
Now we need to hear from AJ. Again, the question is, what are some accommodations you've discussed or would like to discuss with your coach and or administrators?
I feel like I'm going to try to like just think about like myself in the moment, like pretending if I was a student athlete. I would probably just go up to my head coach and say, hey, coach, is it okay if maybe at once a week I could have a quick 10-minute meeting with you just to like just like go over some stuff, maybe even do some personal talks and venting, because I always looked at my coaches as like mentors who have really helped me in the past. And like I said, my hockey coach, even though I wasn't a player, like I always looked up to my coach who always helped me out with like in terms of my future, like after college and stuff like that. I would always talk to him, maybe make that personal connection with your coach. That could help you out a lot better. That way, if he does like call you out or something, he's doing it like at least you know him like really well, so it's much less of an impact. But like Mike says, that doesn't mean like it's good to like have a coach yell at your face and stuff like that, but at least like if he criticizes you, he knows that at least you care about him, and because you established that personal connection with him or her as the head coach. And I think it's been I think that could really help. And also I use the time to go over like your strengths and weaknesses as a player, what you need to get back. What you need to get better. Like I know, like I would not be a fan if I got called out like in a meeting, like during a film session, and if I got called out publicly by my by like in front of my teammates, by my coach, that way like I could explain to the coach, hey, anything you need me to get better, and coach could maybe pull up the film and say, well, here, you did this and you did this and everything. And so I think that'll be much better. So that way, like I know sometimes coaches do have to like criticize like a play, and since it'll have to be at an individual person when going over film, but at least like maybe you could be prepared for it in advance, like and just like when the coach repeats it in front of everybody, you'll be prepared for that to happen and it'll take less of a blow. So it's basically like that. Basically it's like establishing connections, and maybe if you're comfortable speaking to your coach about being on the spectrum, just saying like, hey, look, you know, I have certain strengths and I have certain weaknesses as a player and as a person, and you could like go over with the coach. That way the coach could be prepared, and just like the coach could still help you, like try to improve and everything. And I think that's the best way. But bottom line, it's all about communication and establishing that relationship with your coach.
Yeah, absolutely. That way there's a much better understanding of how the two of you need to communicate moving forward in case something like that does arise. Gentlemen, I now would like you to put yourselves into the position of being an employer. Now, just for clarification purposes, I know AJ, you have been and are currently the head sports information contact at your school. Alan, are you or not?
Yes, I'm the only sports information person at my school. So.
Okay. And Mike, in your previous jobs. Have you been the employer or have you served under someone?
Both. Mostly served under someone. When I was at Peace, I wasn't an employer because it was a one man show there, but yeah, I was the head at that point in time.
Okay. So I'm glad that both Alan and Mike cleared that up for me, because this next question does involve being the employer in this instance. The question is, how do you or how would you handle the hiring process when it comes to interviewing prospective autistic / neurodivergent employees / student workers / interns? Mike, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. All right, there we go. So one thing I would do, and like it's kind of obviously it's a delicate thing, because you know, a lot of times an employer may not know about it. If it is a situation where you do know about it beforehand, I think it's just a very good idea to, you know, reach out to this person a few days before said interview. We know you're coming, whatever day. What can we do to make you as, you know, comfortable as possible in the setting? Is there anything specific you need? Is there anything you like from us? What can we do for you just to kind of make it as smooth a situation for you as possible? And I think most of the time it would be, you know, very minor things, if any, in those kind of instances, but just having, you know, kind of, for me, if I was in that position as a possible, you know, employee, just knowing that somebody was like willing to just take 5 minutes out of their day to just send an email or call me or whatever, just to offer that. It's like, it's something minor, but it does really go a long way in showing that people do actually care about you and your situation and are wanting to help you. So that would just be something I would do, you know, in that kind of situation, just reach out to somebody a few days ahead of time and just kind of go through those questions. Do you need anything? Are you looking for anything specific from us? And more importantly, what can we do to ensure this situation is, you know, as comfortable for you as it possibly can be?
Alan or AJ, any of you would like to jump in on this topic? Alan, go ahead.
Thank you. As I'm considering, you know, when I'm around the interview table and I'm not the one being interviewed, I in addition to the things that Mike had said, this could go for any applicant is ask them how do you learn. What's the best way you learn and how do you learn your skill set for the job? How have you learned skill sets in the past? And what is your best way of communication? You know, questions along those lines. It might help you be able to identify candidates, whether it's for a game day role, student worker roles, or even a full-time role as to who might be neurodivergent. But it, you know, also gives you an idea of really how to, you know, the best way to work with that person if it's someone you want to hire.
Excellent, Alan. AJ, you're last.
Two things. One, regarding appearances, I know I mentioned that briefly earlier. Like, I know some people on the autism spectrum could have like a sensory issues with sensory things. Like, they might not like wearing certain things. They might not like the feel of a certain material. I know, like, it's a possibility that someone on the autism spectrum might not like really not like polyester, like not in terms of like being inconvenient of an inconvenience, but like it really makes them feel uncomfortable and they get really like, it really causes them to like really go like really get like really squirmish and everything. And I'll give you an example. I know this is oddly specific. Like, I cannot wear like a dress shirt without an undershirt. It has to be an undershirt because I wouldn't like the polyester and the buttons like choking my skin sort of. So I really need to wear an undershirt. Like, If I don't have any clean undershirts left, like I'll be like, oh no, I can't wear a dress shirt. What do I do? Just because like it's very uncomfortable. But there might be individuals on the autism spectrum that don't like to wear like the full suit and the tie. They don't like the blazer, how like really stiff it makes them feel, and they might not like the tie like choking their neck. Like I don't mind ties, but the most annoying part I have to do is I could tolerate it, but it's still annoying. Like when I go like this and I have to like put the tie like around, like it's really uncomfortable when this is like against my neck that way. And the point I'm trying to make is like, sometimes I know we all judge and you say, oh, you gotta have a three-piece suit during interviews, oh, you gotta look presentable, But sometimes individuals on the autism spectrum might not like sensory issues. Like I said, I don't mind, like me personally, I don't mind wearing the suit except for like making sure that an undershirt's on and the fact that I have to go like this might put a tie on. But that's why I would feel like you shouldn't judge somebody. Like if I'm not saying it's okay to come in with like a t-shirt or shorts or pajamas or anything like that. But as long as that you're wearing like a polo at least, because I always try not to judge people. Like if I'm interviewing someone, like say they're only wearing like a polo and khakis, at least it looks business casual. But sometimes like we might not like be comfortable wearing a shirt and a tie. And I always feel like at least employees should understand, like as long as they're at least making the effort to look presentable, I think that's okay with me. Plus, even though it's unrelated, someone could have a poor financial background, regardless of whether you have a disability or not. Someone could have a poor financial background and might not be able to afford a full suit, but maybe they'll wear a polo instead. To me, I won't judge a person based on what he or she wears, as long as they're at least looked like a little bit business casual. And another thing I want to point out, there's a second point I wanted to make, but let's see, I'm just trying to remember. It's about sometimes individuals on the autism spectrum or having a disability, since like being neurodivergent, our brains function differently, it could be slower for us to take in information. It doesn't mean we're dumb, it doesn't mean we're slow, it just sometimes we have to like hear a question, we have to like articulate it in our minds, and sometimes like we won't be able to answer for like maybe like 10 full seconds or 20 seconds, but it's there, we just got to process it, then we come out and like it come out verbally. Like I always feel like when employees try to do that, oh, I want to test their quick thinking skills, so I do this or I put them in this situation. But to me, like sometimes even problem solving, it can cause like critical thinking. Like you need to have critical thinking, you need to take your time, think of something. Like, you know, the cliche with journalism, you could be first, but you gotta make sure it's accurate, otherwise you're gonna end up looking ridiculous. I feel like it's the same way. Like, don't be too judgmental, like if it takes someone a long time to answer because they're just thinking about it in minds. Like it takes a little longer for neurodivergent and autistic individuals to process information. Then they got to think about the best answer. Then they'll say the answer. It doesn't mean like I said, it doesn't mean we're slow. It doesn't mean we're dumb. It takes a little longer for us to process, but then when we come out, we'll be able to like structure an answer. So that's why I say, like, don't be judgmental the way someone answers a question or how somebody looks during an interview.
You mentioned a really unique topic in sensory needs, which I think is something that a lot of us who work in collegiate athletics, whether we're working full-time, part-time, or if we're working seasonal, need to consider. As I had mentioned earlier, I have Loop Experience earplugs that I bring with me to just about everywhere I go. Some people also find headphones work when you're in certain environments, whether you're in sports or not. So you've already mentioned apparel and how the feel of certain types of fabric may not be doable for you, whether you're in job interviews or you're in the office or you're working a game. What about those who need to have certain types of objects in their ears or over their ears so that they can feel a little bit more comfortable within their job, talking specifically about earplugs or headphones?
Yeah, I think absolutely that's fine. I think just as a courtesy, I think the individual should let the employers know about the situation. And because I know if somebody walks in, like I know this is a little bit of a off related, but I was not used to like some of my coaches when I was in college, like I didn't realize that headphones were also used like to talk on the phone. So I would just walk in and I'd say, hey, how you doing? And then the headphones are small too, you could barely see them. And then my coach would just go, oh, I'm on the phone. I go, oh, wow, I had no idea that was a phone. But I think but going back to what you asked, like, I think it's important just like give the employee the heads up. Hey, I usually like to use my headphones in certain situations, just to give you a heads up. And the employer should at least should accept that. I think they should, like, whatever makes you work better. And I think that works out great. But I think the employee should let the employer know, just so like the employer is aware, because it would look kind of strange if somebody has like in a certain situation, someone would have their headphones on, which is okay. But I think you should at least let the employers know.
Yeah, headphones can definitely be It can go either way, especially when you're working a certain role at a scores table, especially since you need to hear and see what's going on in order to concentrate. Or at least that's how it's been for me since I've, you know, clearly been a freelancer within this industry. Since all of you have had to go through some sort of interview process, regardless of how many interviews you've had to pass in order to land said job or jobs you've had in the past, describe your experience while being interviewed for full-time, part-time, or seasonal work. So it could be anything from being the head sports information contact, maybe you're a part-time person in the office, maybe you're a GA, or maybe you're a student worker or intern. What has the interview process been like for you? Mike, you're up first.
Well, for me, I would say just because, you know, for the most part, pretty much where it starts and ends as far as the interview process is kind of a little bit what I talked about before, just kind of checking that box on the application. And it's something that it's kind of a double-edged sword because an employer may know about it, but again, like I said earlier, I don't think they're allowed to ask about what your disability is in an interview. So it's something that you know, they may know about, but they can't really get into, or, you know, as far as me, you know, beforehand, I've never asked for anything special during the interview process. It's always been, and because I'm on, you know, kind of that side where, and this is something that I'm going a little bit off topic for a moment, but people have told me when I tell them I'm on the autism spectrum, they say, oh, well, you don't look like it. And I've always thought that's kind of a weird thing to say. And I'm like, do autistic people look a certain way? You know, it's just one of those things that, and I, based on your guys' reactions, I get to tell, like, it bugs everyone. It's just weird and it's annoying. I don't know why people say it. It is what it is, but I digress. But I guess because I quote unquote don't look autistic, I've never been, you know, interviewed a certain way or asked like different kind of questions, at least not that I can pick up on. You know, there have been times where I brought it up in an interview, again, if I felt like it was relevant to what I was talking about. People tell, you know, sometimes they'll give you the question, describe like a personal challenge you overcame, XYZ. And now, you know, if I feel like it's an appropriate thing to talk about based on what they're asking, I will talk about it. But as far as, you know, the specific interview process itself, I've never, you know, been, you know, I guess I would say I've never been, you know, treated any differently than any other candidate based on, you know, my personal experience.
Here's some piece of advice for those of you listening carefully to what Mike just said when, you know, he brings up that he's autistic. And we hear some neurotypical say, oh, you don't look autistic. Well, then they don't look neurotypical either, right? Am I right? I mean, come on. That has definitely caught people off guard. I know this from past experience. Trust me. Anyway, Alan, go ahead.
Similar to Mike's answer, I've never really brought it up in any of my interviews, even the more recent ones I've had within the last 3 or 4 years, even as I'm being more comfortable about checking off that box in the application process. But I haven't really faced any different any questions related to that. Because I'm still pretty new at just realizing that I'm a neurodivergent or not a neurotypical person. I do not have a neurotypical brain. So, I mean, so this whole thing is very new to me too. And so, I mean, I feel like I'm learning as I'm being a part of this podcast. So that's something I'll keep in mind at my next job interview, which hopefully won't be for a while too, because I'd like to settle in for a little while.
You'd also like to keep the job that you've had for a while too, rather than, you know, bounce around, because I think the more jobs you have in your resume, especially in the early portion of your career, the more people are curious about, like, hey, like, why were you here this amount of time, and then why were you here that amount of time, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, definitely understand why you would not want to put yourself in the interview process right after, you know, you just get a new job, or, you know, after you get back to your old employer, in your case, Alan. AJ.
Before I answer, I wanted to say about Mike, I know, I discovered tonight that you were on the autism spectrum, and back to what you said about, now looking at autism, I had no idea you were on the autism spectrum. I met you, a few times, especially at EastCom, and, I had no idea, you were on the spectrum, just because, like you said, there's no such thing as looking autism, looking like you're autistic and everything. So, my best friend, Allison Hoag, for example, I just want to give her a shout out. She couldn't be here tonight, but we interacted a few times via Zoom during the dark days of the shutdown, the pandemic. When she called me a couple of weeks later saying that, she's autistic, I had no idea, because she didn't she didn't look autistic or anything like that. And so I was like, oh, wow, you're on the autism spectrum too. That's awesome. And going back to the, now to answer the question, usually I never reveal during interview processes that I had autism, except for some of the interviews that say, they would take me to the diversity and inclusion person, and they say, what's your experience with diversity and inclusion? And that's when I would open up about my autism, how I advocate for it, how I formed, helped create different committees, the Autism Awareness Club at my alma mater at Utica College. And I would explain all of that and how I preach that people on the autism spectrum and neurodivergence, they're part of the diversity too. Neurodiversity is part of the diversity. And often I feel like oftentimes we get overlooked when it comes to that, when people talk about diversity and inclusion. And as for the interviews themselves, I've enjoyed the sit down interviews. One of my favorite interviews was when I applied for the part-time job at Lehman, my first job outside of being in college and being in graduate school. My boss, Chris Gonzalez, who opened the door for me and eventually ended up hiring me for my first job post-school. And but we just walked, he showed me the facilities and everything. And he asked questions. He told me about the job and everything. And we also had personal conversations about sports, since we're huge sports fans, different sports topics, in between the questions and everything. And that helped me relate to him more, and that made me more comfortable with him. I think those interviews are good too, when you're somehow able to mix shared interests with the questions about the job. I always thought that worked out really cool. And and that was my first interview in a long time too. So that really helped me get out of my shell and everything. And it really helped. So I feel like those interviews really worked. That interview in particular with my boss, Chris Gonzalez, really worked really well.
And that's how you know, especially within, I guess, was it the first or second interview, AJ, that you guys knew that there was some sort of connection between you?
Chris?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. So it was a couple of months after with my master's, and it was pretty much we knew right from the interview that we had seemed to have shared interests, and fortunately I was able to get hired for the job. And so it was pretty much the first year we knew that we were going to be able to work well together. And of course there's always been me being the first year in a sports information capacity, outside of being an intern, it had its ups and downs, but Chris was a great boss, and he really helped me open the door. I remember halfway through the year, he was telling me some stuff he was going through, which naturally led me to respond with, hey, I know how, and I'm actually on the autism spectrum. And so I know what you go through in terms of struggles with what you have and everything, and what you go through. And the first thing he said to me was when I told him I was autistic was, well, I'm going to treat you just like everyone else did, which he did. He gave me praise when I earned it, but he also criticized me when I deserved to be criticized. But it was always a good balance. He treated me like everyone else. He didn't treat me any different just because, he didn't treat me different because I was autistic or anything. He didn't give me coddle me anything, or he gave me criticism when I deserved it. He wasn't mean or angry or thought I was easy or anything like that, and yelled at me just because of my disability. He would do the same exact thing if he'd had another to his other employees as well. So he was a great man. He's a great man for that. And I'll never forget. He's really helped me get to where I am today.
I think when you have that connection with someone and it's instant, in the early part of an interview, that's when you know, like, bam, job's mine. I can breeze through the rest of this interview process, no problem. All right, gents, we have two questions to go. Now, these two, they're mainly for athletes. And I know, obviously, none of us are, you know, current collegiate athletes. We're well beyond our college years. But I would like each of you, if you were to put yourselves in the shoes of a prospective collegiate athlete, so you're maybe a high school junior, you want to go play college sports, right? Describe your experience during the recruiting stages and or campus tours. If you were to put yourselves in the shoes of a college athlete, or in this instance, a high school athlete who wants to play college sports, as an autistic or neurodivergent, what have the recruiting stages and campus tours been like for you? Give you guys another minute or so to get your thoughts in order.
I think the first thing, like, I would check out, like, if I was going to go to college as an athlete, is what accommodations. I would look at the Department of Workers that help with disabilities, because as I said earlier, like, the college has been I worked with the Center for Disabilities, and I've even received counseling there, like a mental health counselor. I would vent to about my struggles and everything, and within social situations, and I felt it was very strong where I went to college, and it really helped me out, like, become a better person, and using the accommodations really helped me. So, like, I know you're thinking athlete, and you're thinking, like, the fancy stadiums or the arenas, and where the cool parties are and stuff like that. But you also got to think about, like, how is it going to help me as an individual on the autism spectrum? What's the vibe there? Are people friendly there, or are they, like, do they seem like they give you cold stares just because you look, or, like, you basically, like, act differently, like, your mannerisms are different because of your neurodivergence? Because I always feel like autism or neurodivergent, it doesn't affect someone's looks, but sometimes they could have different mannerisms that that they could try to mask, like, to make themselves look quote-unquote normal and stuff like that. But sometimes they just like to be themselves, and their mannerisms might be different, and that could, like, rub people the wrong way for some reason. And if people are judgmental like that, is that the place you want to go to? If people, like, seem friendly, and, like, the students are friendly, the workers are friendly and everything, I feel like that's the place I want to go to. And I think that's where I would evaluate as an autistic individual, like, look at the competing college athletics at a college campus.
Thank you, AJ. Over to Alan.
Thank you. In addition to what AJ said about the Office of Disability Services, because that's where I first went as a graduate student at Texas State University when I was going there initially for depression, that's when the idea of ADHD became relevant to me. I never really thought about that office before, but that's their job, is to make sure students are getting the best help that they need. So in addition to something that, what AJ said, I would reiterate 100%. And then also, if I'm from the college athlete perspective, I would also talk to their the academic services within the athletics department, because, you know, not only are they, you know, I feel like they're, it's part of their job to be able to help accommodate athletes in their very unusual schedules and the competition schedule. So I would think they would have some experience in terms of, like, you know, making other accommodations that might be out of the ordinary, that might also impact a neurodivergent or athlete, or an athlete that is on the autism spectrum.
Mike, you're the last one in line. Go ahead.
So I think this is kind of a situation where you almost kind of have to, for a moment, separate athletics for it, just to kind of take a look at, like you need to sit there and worry about, okay, what is best for me, the person, not what is best for me, the athlete. like, you know, I never played, you know, college athletics. I was on the crew team in high school, and the second our last race ended, I was out of there in a hot second. And, you know, 6 a.m. practices on the Hudson River for 3 years will do that to you. But you just have to sit there and, you know, kind of evaluate, like, yes, this place might be the best place for me athletics wise, but is it the best place for me academically, personally? Am I going to, you know, have separation anxiety if I, you know, go to a, you know, a college that's, you know, opposite side of the country? So like, there's a lot of factors that go into play there. Like, speaking from personal experience, when I moved to Boston, I was there for 10 months, and, you know, within a few weeks I was having panic attacks every day. So, you know, that's just something that, you know, it's not necessarily going to happen to everybody, but it's just something that you need to take into consideration when looking at, okay, yes, this is a good place athletically, maybe this is the best school athletics wise, and maybe it's a great opportunity for me to learn from, you know, some of the better coaches, better players, X, Y, Z, but is it best for me, the human being? And that's, I think, the most important thing. What is best for me, the human being, not what is best for me, the baseball player or whatever it is. So that's something you need to kind of evaluate, and you need to separate one from the other and then make the best decision based on what is best for you as a person.
Then the final question, which kind of ties hand in hand to this, you know, question I just bring up about recruiting stages and campus tours. And as we are recording this podcast, we are in a very unique stage where we're starting to hear a lot about college basketball players, maybe other collegiate athletes who are entering the transfer portal, and they've made their decision, or they're in the process of receiving offers from other schools that maybe they want to check out and say, you know, maybe I like playing there a little bit more than I do here. So if you were an autistic or neurodivergent athlete who was planning to make a transfer and go to another college, what would your experience look like? If you were in the transfer portal, what would it look like for you? Alan.
Well, I first would have to look at what, why am I in the transfer portal? What things are causing me to realize that this place I'm currently at is not where I want to be for the next two or three years, or however much eligibility I would have left. And it would also, and if we're talking from a neurodivergent or athlete or an athlete on the autistic spectrum, you know, it has to be, you know, you would have to look at more factors than just, you know, am I not getting enough playing time? So, you know, but what is it that is not working for my brain and my person? And maybe it's a coaching staff, maybe it's the schedule, or am I too far away from home? It's like, yeah, you have to look at every factor that's causing you to think that this should not be where I'm supposed to be, and what would make the next stop more attractive, and, you know, whether, you know, what accommodations, you know, the coaching personality, or it's just addressing what didn't work at the first place and what worked at the second, but what would work ideally at your next stop.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you need to consider a lot of factors into play before you even think about, you know, having that conversation with yourself. You know, do I like where I am? Do I not like where I am? What would work better if I were to enter the transfer portal? What risks am I taking if I choose to enter the transfer portal? So those are very good things to mention. Mike, your hand's up. Go ahead.
So I would say, you know, when looking at, you know, potentially going into a portal or things of that nature, I would sit there and say, I need to 100% make sure there is a place out there, a different school that is better for me than where I'm at right now. I need to, you know, weigh every pro and con. Again, kind of like what Alan said, why am I going into the portal? What are the benefits of me going in? What are the negatives of me going in? But I need to 100% make sure there is a place out there that is better for me athletically, academically, and personally. Because those are obviously the three important things. If you can find a place that checks all three boxes, you know, God bless, more power to you. But, you know, sometimes, you know, grass isn't always greener. So you need to kind of sit there and can just kind of weigh those positives and negatives. And at least for me, I would just sit there and take a lot of time, take, you know, several weeks to sit there and look at every, okay, here are some of the places I'm looking at, and come up with my list of, okay, here's where I am now. Here are all the places that I would like to go to and that I think would be a good opportunity for them, or for me rather. And then sit there and you kind of just kind of do your research on those schools. What do they have in place? Do they have those resources in place on campus for people with disabilities and things like that? And, you know, is it better, you know, location wise? And, you know, there's so much to kind of take into consideration for it. But at least for me, the number one thing is you need to 100% make sure there is a place out there that you're looking at that is a better situation for you in all aspects.
Thanks, Mike. AJ, I don't think you've gone yet. So if not, floor is yours.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to piggyback what Mike said about like the grass always being greener or the grass not always being greener. Like everything may seem like attractive, like on the outside, everything seems perfect. Like I take it the same way when I look at schools and, you know, I may have worked as a per diem, as a freelancer. This seems great. The school seems great, but you got to be careful. What are the behind the scenes? What the behind the scenes? Because it's all about the behind the scenes. Is everything more of a struggle and everything just looks great on game day, but everything's more of a struggle behind the scenes? And I think the same thing with the transfer portal. The school may seem like great on TV, it could be in a great location, but you gotta figure out, like I said earlier, I think it's worth repeating, like, how friendly are the people there? Are they going to be accepting of you for who you are? And I think those are questions you have to ask, and you probably won't be able to find out till you get there. So that's why I would plan at least like a campus visit, get a vibe, maybe test it out, say hi to people, see how they react. And you don't want to like generalize like a population based on a few people, but you want to get like at least a sense of the culture, like of the school. Like I said, not every individual is going to be great at a school. Not every individual is going to be terrible at a school, but just try to get some vibes of like the program, of like the students there. And you just got to go with what you're comfortable with. If it seems like a friendly environment, it's all about the people, like I say. And I know like sports are important and everything, but I feel like the only reason why I would leave a school as an athlete, maybe for better playing time, but or maybe moving to a place that's closer to home. But what about the people? Like, if you're treated like really like bad there, like by people, if you're bullied, you're gonna want to leave right away. Like, absolutely. And you figure like, well, the situation can't get any worse than this. But to me, for me to leave personally, like, it would absolutely have to be bad for me to leave.
Yeah, bullying can definitely be a big reason why someone would want to leave their current place and go somewhere else where, you know, you would want to be treated just as fairly and as humanly possible as everyone else. Well, gentlemen, we are running out of time. I want to thank each of our panelists again for joining me tonight on autism and neurodiversity in the workplace, working in college athletics while being autistic and neurodivergent. Anthony O'Hagan, sports information director at Monroe College, the Bronx. Mike Puglisi, the former head athletic communications contact at Pace University. And Alan, I know I'm going to screw your last name up again. I think it's Wiederhold Sun. Yes, got it right the first try. The head sports information director at Houston Tillotson University. Please tell me I got that part right.
Houston Tillotson University.
Tillotson. Okay. See, I knew I was going to screw part of it up. I got Houston right, even though it's not spelled like Houston, Texas.
Right.
Thanks again for all of you who have been tuning in to today's podcast. Again, this is Autism and Neurodiversity in the Workplace. Tune into our next session as we discuss family members of autistic and neurodivergent individuals. So long, everyone.